The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
How are you, sir?
This is Pierre.
Oh.
I can't believe I'm talking to you, Dr. A the Great.
Well, I don't know about that.
I love listening to you. You have a personality just like my father.
I don't think you should feel helpless. You are helpless.
Doctor, I really appreciate that. That makes me feel a lot better.
You be at peace, or else I'm going to yell at you. I'm
trying to find a reason to speak to you. I think you're the best thing since sliced bread.
That Ray, he's something.
Thank you so much for what you're doing for all the parents out there.
I don't know what I can possibly do.
I don't either.
I'm getting my money worth, I think, at this phone call.
Now, from the studios of Living Bread Radio Network in Canton, Ohio, the hometown of Mother Angelica, here's Dr. Ray.
I just got this on an e-person here a few weeks back. A delightful lady goes by the name of Dr. K called the program from Springfield, Illinois. And I made the observation that I was under the impression that Springfield, Illinois was the most common city name in the U.S. But then someone early on had corrected me and said, no, it's not. But I didn't know which one was. Well, this came from Ken. It's just interesting. He said, the most common city names in the U.S. according to the World Atlas. Number one, 88 different cities and towns are named Washington. There it is. That's number one. I wasn't totally off. Number two was Springfield. First place was in Springfield, Massachusetts in 1636, shortly before Teresa Tomeo was born. Yeah. Named after Springfield in Essex, England. Springfield, number two. Number three, Franklin, 35 different cities. Springfield has 41. And Greenville. Now, I was just in Greenville, South Carolina, not so long ago. 30. So there you have it. Thanks, Ken. I appreciate so much for that. Give me a little bit of fodder here before I gave the introduction to this Look Back Friday on The Doctor Is In. The way we do Look Back Friday is certain earlier calls are selected for multiple reasons. Whether there was an angle that I wanted to take, but I couldn't because the caller had a more urgent request. Or there was a term used that I would have wanted to explain, but didn't have time. Or it brings up something that is very common, but it wasn't necessarily related directly to the call. So those calls are selected. But I would say the most common reason why calls are selected for Look Back Friday is simply because of selfishness. I just want to talk more. Yep, I did not get enough chance to talk as much as I wanted to talk, and therefore I said, okay, well, I'm going to talk some more. So we will get to those momentarily. Some years ago, I was listening to a large station, a large talk station, talking about the divorce rate of those who lived together before marriage being noticeably higher than those who don't live together before marriage. The host of the show was perplexed. He said, this doesn't make any sense. Obviously, if you live with someone in the quasi-context of a marriage relationship, you'd get to know them a lot better. You'd know if you're suited. You'd know what they're like. You'd see them up close and personal. Then you would have a better chance at a successful marriage should you tie the knot. And he couldn't understand why that was not the case. It went counter to his reasoning and the dominant secular reasoning. I called in. And I said, I'm a psychologist. I'd like to offer an explanation for this. So he accepted it. Or at least he accepted my offer. He didn't accept my explanation. I said, do you think there is some difference between those who choose to live together and those who don't in their view of marriage? Those who live together would be more likely to say marriage really isn't the lifelong commitment, in my view of things, that it would be for me. This is living together. This is kind of this trial and error kind of thing. And if you do the trial and error living together, well, why would you not just do the trial and error being married? Further, I would say that there's probably a religious difference in people who say, no, we're not going to live together prior to marriage. Because morally, given I believe in God, and given that I believe in Christ's understanding of the best way to live for us, that living together is wrong. He didn't buy any of that. He didn't like it. Not at all. He didn't agree with it. And I wanted to say, if he'd have kept me on the air, he didn't keep me on the air very long. But I wanted to say, wouldn't it be interesting to see what percentage of people who don't live together prior to marriage for religious and moral reasons, what is their divorce rate compared to those who do? Now, there may be a lot of reasons why people live together before marriage. One of the big ones, of course, is finances. Another one is, well, it's just convenient. You know, no sense having two places. Might as well just have one. So the moral reason, if that's taken into account, I'd love to see a survey on this. It's kind of related to those who practice natural family planning. The divorce rate among those who practice natural family planning is well below 5%. Now, what does that reflect? Does that reflect something about natural family planning that makes marriages successful? Or is natural family planning a sign of how people view not only marriage, but commitment and children and religion till death do us part? So I suspect, he didn't give me much time to talk about it on the air. That's why I can talk about it now, because I think this show has a much bigger audience than his did. I suspect that that's the explanation. Interestingly enough, and sadly enough, under age 35, more people are now living together than are married. And more people now have children out of wedlock under age 35 than in wedlock. So the question becomes, will this have an effect on society? Or is this just another option that one might say, yeah, you know, marriage is for some people, it's not for me. Yeah, it's just a piece of paper. We can live together. Things are going good. Our relationship's a lot better than some of the people that I know who are married, that's for sure. Oh, yeah, all those kinds of cliche rationalizations float all over the place. But in fact, what happens to a society when you take the family and you fracture it and you say, at best, it is one option? And the irony is this. If the family and marriage is one option among multiple, that really lowers the value of that option. I mean, it's just a selection on the shelf. Well, yeah. Why don't we get married, okay? We can do that. I mean, we've been living together for 4 years. Why don't we just get married? What's the difference here? We can do that. If that's how it's viewed, then it's no surprise that the divorce rate post-living together in marriage now is higher than those folks who haven't lived together. Makes perfect sense to me. When we come back, let's see who I'm going to go to here. Oh boy, Peter is really, really, really wrestling with something that he's wondering, should he be transparent about with his wife? I'm Dr. Ray.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria Mutual Funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
60 Seconds with Father Mitch Pacwa.
The state has responsibility to orient things, but they can't take over the rights of the family, like in China, to have one child and that's it. It's a disaster over there. How many tens of millions of abortions have gone on? And one of the things that, as a result of that, is because of the preference to have boy children rather than girls, you have, for every 1,000 boys, there are 850 girls. This is a great imbalance. Same thing is going on in northern India. So this is where the government cannot take away the primary and inalienable responsibility of married couples and families. And they cannot employ methods which fail to respect the person and fundamental human rights. Beginning with the right to life, the government cannot force you to kill innocent human beings and still be a humanistic government. It's an evil government.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Very nice to have you with me here on The Doctor Is In on this Look Back Friday, the variant of The Doctor Is In on most Fridays. We do this, take previous calls, edited at the capable hands of my producer man, Andrew Krucek. And then I get to talk some more about him. So Peter from New York brings up a common question, especially in marriages. How much do I talk about my past?
So I have a question. What do you do when you thought you'd forgiven somebody for something, maybe a while ago, and it's sort of creeping back into my mind, into my heart? I'm not sure if I should bring it up with the person or not.
Do they even know they did anything wrong?
I don't know. I have never brought it up with them. Specifically, but maybe on their own they came to realize. I can't quite know that without speaking to them. True.
to somebody close in your life or just an acquaintance?
Oh, yeah, it's my wife.
That's pretty close. It's pretty close.
Pretty close.
So apparently, this was how long ago, Peter?
This is early on our marriage, first year or two. So we've been married for 13 years.
How was it that this popped back up?
Well, you know, my wife and I do not see things the same. I hate to use the word political world, but, you know, in world issues, there's a lot of rub there, a lot of abrasion. And I don't want to make myself seem like I'm something that I'm not. But, you know, no matter what her stances are on things, I still love her, you know. It's not like a deal breaker for me. I feel like we're both trying to grow closer to God, and I trust in God that through that turning out to be a slow but and sometimes painful process of both seeking the truth, we are growing closer, sometimes at molasses pace, but I do notice improvement in that area. But of course, with the state of the world today, these issues come up a lot. So sometimes when I feel like I am, you know, like I have to be quiet or it's not worth bringing certain things up, there's a lot of heavy-duty topics that don't get talked about between each other, and this has to do with that. This would have been an issue like that back then that I found to be very hurtful.
So because of that, the first year of marriage, she reacted in a way that was not only disagreement, but she did something about it. That hurt you. It looks here, it says like you were uninvited from a trip, apparently, when you were
exactly.
married. You can't go. Okay. Now, back then, did you just let it go? Did you say, okay, I'm not gonna chase this. I'm gonna let it go, and in fact, we'll proceed with our marriage, and I won't carry the ill will. Is that what happened?
No, I if I had to go back, I can't remember exactly, but I'm pretty sure me back then would have said something like, this is ridiculous. You know, I can't believe, you know, the degree to which you're responding to something that I find to be trivial.
What takes me back to my original question. Did she even think she was wrong in doing that?
No, I don't think she back then she didn't think she was wrong. Now, over 10 years, like I said, I have seen some growth in both of us, of course. So I don't know if she would say the same or do the same now. But I'm looking to find out. I don't like.
Well,
I said,
what would
up a lot
what would
topics.
Yeah? What would prompt you to bring up something from 13 years ago that she might apologize?
Why would I do that? I don't know. Yeah. We struggle with communication. We're actually going to go speak to somebody in September about that, and you know, there seems to be like a repetitive pattern. Things are going well for a long time, then all of a sudden these things rear their ugly heads up, and we're trying to get to the bottom of it. And I know I can be a keep the peace, quote unquote, type of person, or, you know, is it worth it to bring this up? What are the fruits of this conversation going
to
be?
You want me to guess,
and
Peter,
I struggle with that.
It'll blow up in your face.
Okay,
first of all, it's long gone. There's been a lot of marriage since. There's been some movement toward each other and understanding where you differ. But if you say to yourself, that was such a hurtful thing in my mind that somehow I've got to get closure to it so that she acknowledges what she did, and now after all these years, she will give me some sign that she regrets it. You don't need that. She may not even remember she did it. That's the other problem. And so at this point, I would suggest a couple of things. One, lay it to rest. Long gone. You focus on what you guys are getting along with now. But here's the other thing. Instead of, you say we have a hard time discussing these different political perspectives, social perspectives. Instead of trying to convince her to look at your perspective, immerse yourself in trying to understand how she got her perspective. In other words, she may say, I think Trump's a demon, which is a very common political perspective now. Okay, how did you come to that? Well, I don't like his personality. I don't like the way he talks. I don't like his personality. I think he's abrasive. I think he's arrogant. I think he's self-centered. Okay. So you don't like his personality. What didn't you like about some of the things he did governing-wise? Instead of saying, well, you know, you're not electing a pastor. You're not electing a lily white guy. So don't worry about it. I mean, he's done a lot of good. No, don't do that, because then it'll just be I say, you say. Find out. Get her to explain. I've talked to a lot of non-Catholic friends, and I've asked them to explain how they've gotten to their conclusions about the Catholic Church. And as they try to explain them, some of them realize, I haven't really thought these through very well at all. I'm just uttering cliches. So that's the thing I would suggest with her. Just, I want to know how you think, why you think it, how you came to that conclusion, what you're basing it on, what have you heard, what have you watched, where are you watching it, that kind of thing. There's two things that struck me during the call. One is impatience. Peter acknowledged things were changing, but unspoken was they're not changing fast enough. So we've been married 13 years. We're coming closer together, inch by inch. We are an impatient folk. We want things to change quicker. And so the frustration comes in rather than saying things are getting better, because I'll ask that with clients. I'll say, is your son getting better? Oh, yeah, he's better. But they're still blah, blah, blah. I go, yeah, okay, but is it improving? Yes. And they're frustrated because it's not improving at the rate they want it to improve. And I'll tell you what, if you're going to demand that human beings improve at the rate that you would like them to improve, you're going to be frustrated. But I think the second lesson that I got out of Peter's call was a very common perspective. He was dissed. What she did 13 years ago in not allowing him to go on some trip or journey because of the way he thought was a tremendous overreaction. It was a put down. She did this to me. How could she? I'm wondering if 13 years later, she's come along in her open-mindedness towards some of my views, that she would recognize that was an overreaction on her part. There was a component I picked up in between the lines. There was a component, and this is oftentimes a driver of revisiting past hurts, which is, do you now realize what you did to me? I didn't deserve that. That was incredibly disrespectful. And as long as you realize it, I can somewhat lay it to rest. But if you don't realize it, if you still cling to the idea that you were justified in saying what you said, in doing what you did, then I'm not sure I can rest easy and put that into the past. I think that's where Peter is. He wants her to acknowledge that she disrespected him. She mistreated him. I don't know if she'd be at that point. I have no idea. But I could easily see her saying, why are you bringing this up 13 years later? People don't like that, really, when you bring up the past, especially that far back. They just don't. I can't say this for sure, but my guess would be there's an inverse relationship. The further back an offense is in the past, the number of years back that it goes, the higher the defensiveness to when somebody brings it up. So I'd say to Peter, just let that one go and recognize that she is different in her thinking right now. And that difference might be a softness. But if he brings it up, taking a big risk.
Bishops in the Catholic Church are heralds of faith, according to the Catholic Catechism. Their first task is to teach and preach the gospel to all men and women. In this, they are endowed with the authority of Christ. Christ, who is truth itself, willed to confer on the Church a share in his own infallibility in order that the people of God have true guidance as to his teaching. Christ thus endowed the Church's shepherds with the gift of infallibility when instructing in matters of faith and morals. The Pope enjoys infallibility when he proclaims by a definitive act a doctrine of faith and morals. This same infallibility is present in the College of Bishops only when, together with the Pope, they exercise the supreme magisterium, particularly in an ecumenical council. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
The Catholic Church teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. Feeding 5,000 from a boy's 5 barley loaves and 2 fish, as recorded in John chapter 6, is quite a miracle. Yet the next day, Jesus downplays it in verse 27. Do not work for the food that perishes, but for the food that endures for eternal life, which the Son of Man will give you. Likewise, God's provision of manna to the Israelites in the desert was also a great miracle, yet Jesus similarly downplays it in verse 49. Your ancestors ate the manna in the wilderness, but they died. This is the bread that comes down from heaven, so that one may eat of it and not die. Jesus is clearly stating that his Eucharist is greater than both of these amazing miracles, and the Catholic Church absolutely takes him at his word. Examining the truths of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
I better hurry up because, given the amount of time I have here between the next break, I want to get Camille in enough time that I can talk to. Camille from Washington, D.C. says, and by the way, which, as I said, is the number one name of towns, 88 towns in the U.S. named Washington. She says reinforcers don't work. Let's see what she means.
I'm a religious ed teacher, and I've also been a history teacher. Always been around middle school children, who, you know, a difficult time period to teach.
Anyway, you're my hero. You're my hero.
I like to give, like, play bingo for, you know, vocabulary and do all kinds of creative stuff and give prizes, but I don't do it all the time, and sometimes I don't give prizes, and sometimes I do. But believe it or not, they get, like, tired of the prizes. You know, they're like, oh, is this all you got us? And I'm like... I mean, like, you know, it's lollipops or whatever. They're like, well, can't we get, you know, anything else? So, I mean... I don't think reinforcing them all the time works. I think it's much better with intermittent, but sometimes that even falls flat for me.
All right, you be the analyst.
Kids are so jaded now.
Well, that you're segueing into my question, my dear. You analyze this. Why do you think it is that something that you thought would be preferable, they'd like it? They look at it like, Peggy Lee song. Is that all there is? Why do you think that is?
I don't know if it's because I teach in a private school and maybe they get a lot of things all the time from their parents. You know, they get iPads and all, you know, the top of the line stuff, and maybe they just expect stuff now.
I think you hit it.
So
the. There's, again, I'm going to draw a parallel here to research. When they get mice or rats to perform certain types of behavior by using reinforcers, what they found was that there has to be a state of deprivation. I remember reading one study that said the body has to be at about 80% of its optimum weight for food pellets to work. That
wow.
Seems to be the max. Well, from what you described, American children materially, as a general rule, are not deprived. They get a boatload of stuff. You get your hair cut, you get a rubber spider. You know your CCD verses. You get a bag of candy, a 6 sticker books. You go out to eat. Food's never enough. You got to get something to go with it. So everywhere they go, in general, especially kids who are middle class or above, they get a lot of stuff. And so your rewards are kind of like, look, I got 27 suckers at home, and I'm not that big on these sucker things. So I think you've tapped into it.
But go ahead. Can I just say this one thing? And I absolutely love your show, and I try to listen to you every day at work. Anyway, I'm not doing work, I'm listening to your show. But when I have a child who comes in my room and says, "Hey, I forgot my snack or whatever," and I pull out a cookie, then they're so happy. So I understand what you're saying. I think that they don't have as much a need for these tokens as maybe when I was a kid. I thought it was great to get a lollipop, you know.
Well, sure. My grandparents used to tell me, for example, my mother-in-law told me that for Christmas in her stocking, they got an orange. And they were ecstatic. Fresh fruit for a gift. You put an orange in a kid's stocking right now, he's going to turn you into children's services. It's true. So you're right.
True.
That when let me reverse this. Parents will say to me, "I've taken away one of his privileges. The thing that I think he most likes to do, because he did this, I took that privilege away, and it didn't even bother him." And I'll say, "Well, what's his life normally like?" "Oh, he has so much. He gets to go, do, get, have. I said, "Well, you know what you did? You just scraped a little bit of icing off the cake is all you did. So, yeah, he can live without it because he's got 27 other things to occupy his time." So it's kind of a reverse of what you're saying, but it's a phenomenon that's very true. I'll share with you something. I volunteered years ago when I was just out of high school at the Toys for Tots. You remember Toys for Tots?
Yeah, I do.
I stopped doing it after 3 years because the kids would come in, and I'd be all excited to show them some toy, and they'd go, "I already have one of those. Let me see something I don't have." Oh, yeah, that was very common. Very common. And these are generally poorer kids, but they still had a lot of that stuff. And the Toys for Tots were not really a toy that I get absolutely nothing at Christmas time, so this one toy means the world to me. There wasn't a whole lot of that. There was, "Well, let me see what you got here that I don't have." When I was in grad school, we had to learn a lot about token systems, tangible reward systems, things that you could give kids identifiable material rewards for conduct that you wished, whether it's a sticker, a token, some kind of money, if you will. And the theory was, of course, that the material rewards would motivate the kind of behavior that you wished, some type of socially appropriate behavior. And then you could fade out the material rewards because the social rewards, which is recognition or compliments or a sense of pride in being able to conduct oneself well, maturely, would take over. Now, that was the theory. It's kind of like the old, "We're going to do a chart for the refrigerator for you to make your bed. And we'll give you a sticker every time you make your bed or you make an attempt at making your bed when you're 6 years old. And we'll get you a sticker. And then over time, the stickers will become important and they'll motivate you to make your bed. And pretty soon you'll like making your bed because you'll have a sense of accomplishment and satisfaction. And we can fade out the stickers and I can compliment you on making your bed and you could feel like a grown-up person." And that's all nice on paper, but it didn't work. What they found was exactly what Camille finds. That the
material rewards, they lost their impetus. They weren't as valuable. It habituated. A term I've used before, hedonic adaptation. You get used to it. It's the same old, same old. The other problem is that tangible rewards only work, as I said, when there's a state of deprivation. American children, oh shoot, you're getting cut off. I want to talk a little bit more about this on the other side. I want to talk about the fact that American children materially, even sadly, those who are in the most turbulent situations, have a massive amount of material stuff, far beyond anything 2-3 generations ago had. I'll get to that in a moment.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
The saints are very, very aware of us. Revelation 5 talks about the bowls of incense or the prayers of the saints. We ask them for their intercession, and they love praying for us. St. Teresa said, I'm going to spend my time in heaven doing good on earth. And the reason people are walking through this life of sainthood, you know, they start as venerable, then move to blessed, and then move, God willing, to canonization, is because they're interceding. In other words, they're taking requests to Jesus on our behalf. The prayers of intercession to the saints result in miracles, confirmed miracles that are tested exhaustively. So the church is built on solid ground when it comes to the intercession of the saints.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
In the midst of our culture today, in this age of relativism, which wants to grant Jesus some significance, but not so much, so we'll give him wise man, great leader, inspiring preacher, great teacher, prophet. You don't get that option when you claim to be God. What reasons do we have to believe that he is who he said he is? And it's important, again, to employ the use of our reason and to understand that faith is not blind. My faith, and please God, the faith of everyone here, is not blind. It rests on something. It rests on a number of things, not least of which is my own experience of God, but it also has something substantial which can be claimed through history. We're not talking about a galaxy long, long ago, far, far away when we talk about Jesus. We're talking about a precise moment in history which has been testified to by countless testimonies, and you and I have access to them.
You maybe might be my favorite radio person.
Wait a minute. Maybe might be? I'm looking back on a look back. Dr. Ray Guarendi here, the program Look Back Friday. I'm looking back on a call from Camille from Washington, D.C. She is a middle school teacher, and she's found that her tangible rewards that she uses in the classroom relatively quickly lose impact. Old news. Last week, bottom of the bird cage. And she was wrestling with what is going on here. My father grew up in the Depression. he had very little. Very, very, very little. When he went to work at age 16 to support the family, he turned his paycheck over to his mother completely. He didn't have anything. But that's the way it was. And that's the way it was for pretty much everyone around him. As an interesting sidelight, my dad went to St. Anthony Parish in Canton, Ohio, which was the home parish of Rita Rizzo, Mother Angelica. So my dad didn't have materially much of anything. But he didn't consider himself poor. He didn't look around and say, wow, I wish I had that. No, that was pretty much the society or the closed social circle that he grew up in, an Italian community. Nowadays, even those children who are in sadly fragmented families, broken families, or what would be considered below the poverty line in the U.S., materially dwarf whatever my father had growing up. And my father was not considered, he was considered probably lower middle class. And because of that, when these theories of behavioral shaping and reinforcement using tangible rewards are implemented, they run their course rather quickly. Because to be effective, they have to be something the kids really want. And the average teacher, the average parent who uses stickers or tokens or whatever, the kids have more than the system gives them. Small example. I don't know how many of you have 5, 6, 7, 8, 9-year-old girls, especially. How many stuffed animals do they have? Now you might say, well, yeah, but these stuffed animals are special. She got that one from grandma, and she got that one last Christmas, and that's her favorite one right there, and she always sleeps with that favorite one. And very quickly, 10, 12, 15, 20, 25, 30 stuffed animals are not unusual. Not unusual. So how valuable is a stuffed animal when it is divided up between the other 26? That might be valuable because it's a special one and that's her favorite one. That's her favorite bunny. Could be, sure. But a new one would just go on the pile. We used to have a rule with our kids, one stuffed animal. And if you got a second one, you decided which one you want, and then we'll give the other one to some type of children's home or the hospital or someplace, even though now they don't take stuffed animals anymore because of health conditions and all of that. But back then it wasn't a problem, as long as we kept them clean, which was a problem when you have little kids. Why do we do that? Because we really wanted to do what we could to keep the kids from getting to the point where, I already have 12 of those. I already have 9 of those. And that's very, very easy to do. Those of you who, let's go to the other end of the spectrum. Those of you who are moving, let's say, for example, elderly parent or parents to a different living situation because they just no longer can stay in their home anymore. Or, more tragically, they have passed away. And you go in. And you are going to now decide how to sort through the accumulation of a lifetime. I see and listen to so many 50, 55, 60-year-old adult children who are essentially shocked at how very, very, very much has been accumulated over that time. You know, for example, you know, dad's kind of been a handyman, but he's got 17 hammers. He's got 26 various screwdrivers. Now, again, one can ask the question, why? What is the reason? Did they just come in, or did he see it and he liked it? I remember when even my dad who grew up poor, I remember his workbench after he passed away. I looked at it and I thought, my gosh, Dad, how many screwdrivers do you have? And they all pretty much did the same thing. Most of them were flathead. Most of them were hexagonal. Phillips. But at the same time, even Pop, over the years. So what do you do with them? You know, most people don't get rid of them. But it's a fascinating study on how that kind of accumulation occurs. And my wife and I have discovered that if we don't consistently go through our things, whether there's clothes, whether it's
various things that come in from different gifts or even in the mail from stuff, if we don't consistently go through it, it just accumulates. Drawers are jammed. Closets are stuffed. Some people have, you can't park in the garage because there's no room for the car because they got so much stuff in the garage. It's an interesting phenomenon that occurs when you have material plenty. And that kind of context in our society is definitely affects kids. Affects kids because they grow up thinking this is what I should have. This is as much as I should have. This is when I should have it. It's an interesting phenomenon. All right, I'm going to take a break, come back, get our last call in.
The most amazing saints from modern times, John Paul II, Maximilian Kolbe, and Maria Faustina with the Divine Mercy. This is Steve Ray. We invite you to join us on a pilgrimage to Poland and experience this incredible Catholic country. The land of saints, Catholic culture, gorgeous churches and shrines, and delicious food. Join us next April as we again visit Poland, one of our favorite pilgrimage destinations.
Find the Ave Maria Radio travel tab at avemariaradio.net.
When and how did Jesus allow some of his apostles to see him in his glory? After entrusting to Peter the keys to govern the house of God, the church, the Lord began to reveal to his followers that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things, including death, but that on the third day he would be raised from that death. It is during this period, according to the Catholic Catechism, that he takes Peter, James, and John up on a high mountain and there unveils his divine glory for a very brief time. His clothing, his face become dazzling with light. He also reveals he must go by way of the cross in Jerusalem to enter his glory. All the Trinity is present for the Transfiguration, the Father in the voice declaring Jesus to be his beloved Son, the Son in Jesus, the Spirit in the cloud that covers Jesus. The Transfiguration gives us a window on Jesus' glorious coming and our own transformation from a lowly body to a glorious body like his. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
He is honored by the Church as a saint with the title of the Angelic Doctor.
Matthew Bunsen and the Doctors of the Church.
St. Thomas Aquinas wrote a basic textbook for young theology students that became the Church's most famous guide to the faith, the Summa Theologica. It helped him earn the title Doctor of the Church. He died in 1274.
For more about the Doctors of the Church, visit doctorsofthechurch.com.
Shrink wrap.
Dr. Ray, you're just great.
Hey, Sherman, no feelings, don't know where you're at. Can't hear what you're saying, just can't go with that. My inner child says he's stunned, My grown-up self says it's a no-brainer, duh. Psycho rap, ain't doing no babble, just can't go with that. Psycho rap, you hear what I'm saying? This ain't no shrink chat. Super ego is unconscious for sure. Freudian analysis, 6 grand or more. Head shrinking, mind blowing, brain lock, yes, hypnosis, neurosis, halitosis, Primal scream, fairy dream, bad scene, yeah. Kid's a brat, made him sat, got a swat, wow. Time out, tune in, listen up, yo. Don't blame me if your kid's on the Springer show. Psycho rap, ain't doing no babble, just can't go with that. Psycho rap, you hear what I'm saying, this ain't no shrink chat. Pavlov's dogs, does that ring a bell? Repression, depression, who can tell? Psychology, neurology, pathology, what? Therapy, sympathy, apathy, gut. OD, ADD, PHE. I know all the letters of the alphabet, C. PMS, IRS, EIEIO. There ain't no combinations, I don't know. Psycho rap, ain't doing no babble, just can't go with that. Psycho rap, you hear what I'm saying, this ain't no shrink cat. Oral stage, anal stage, lysis stage, yep. Antipas, animus, maximus, stop. Reflect, deflect, reject, where it's at. I'm okay, you're okay, your kid could be a bat. Self-esteem, self-image, self is all. I am me and ego, you all. Assertiveness training, don't get in my way. The only real truth is what I say. Psycho rap, ain't doing no babble, just can't go with that. Psycho rap, you hear what I'm saying, this ain't no shrink chat.
That was a well-plotted piece of non-claptrap that never made me want to retch.
Man, it's gotten into you.
Okay, it was 1980s type rap, but I figured I'd give it a shot. I did write that. It's kind of a high-pitched sort of vocalization. Andrew Kruchek and I, my producer man, decided we were not going to try to take on another look back call because that would have pushed us all the way against the closing moments of the program. So what I decided to do is I've got about 4 minutes. I want to talk about this. This is from C.S. Lewis. He wrote this to Letters to an American Lady. May God's grace give you the necessary humility. Try not to think, much less speak, of their sins. One's own are a much more profitable theme. And if on consideration one can find no faults on one's own side, then cry for mercy. For this must be a most dangerous delusion. I don't know about you, but I have to constantly beat over the head my awareness of what someone else isn't doing right, where someone else is falling morally short. In my opinion, my perspective, than where I am. It's a fascinating study. I talk about it in one of my books, where when someone has some kind of shortcoming or some piece of behavior or conduct that is negative, we are much more likely to attribute that to some deficiency in them. For example, someone might trip coming down the steps. We would be more prone to say, well, he's kind of clumsy. Yeah, he's not exactly the most light on his feet individual. Were I to trip coming down the steps, I would be more likely to say, wow, this carpet isn't tacked down very tightly, is it? So my tendency is to see quickly in someone else their personal shortcoming. And my personal shortcoming can be explained. I've used the analogy of, if you ask a Christian, are you a sinner? I would think pretty much every Christian would say, yes, I am. Yes, I am. And they would use that as a humble acknowledgement of a recognition that, in fact, they fall short. I'm a sinner. Got it. However, were you to point out a specific sin, for example, you brag, or you're gossiping, you're quick to gossip, whatever that specific sin might be, that's where you meet resistance. No, wait a minute. No, well, what about you? I don't do that. I didn't do that. Well, I did it once, but that's not who I am. That's not. So I'll admit, if you keep it generic, nice and fuzzy, nice and vague, I'm a sinner. Okay, I'll accept that. Yes, we all are, aren't we? Don't get too specific. You get specific, that's where I will resist you. I will defend myself. I will make excuses. I will justify. I will point out that your perception is a little askew. Might want to look at yourself. Lewis says that. He says, don't focus on somebody else's sins. It's easy to do. That's the natural bent. Focus on your own.
He calls it a more profitable theme. Well, that's his way of expressing himself in his more literary style. But what he's saying is you got a lot more material if you focus on your own. Make your prayer be, Lord, would you show me exactly who I am? And then give me the grace and strength to do something about it. Thanks for joining me on this Look Back Friday on this The Doctor Is In. I'm Dr. Ray Guarendi. Thanks, Andrew Krucek. Thanks to all of you. I appreciate the company. Walk with God. He'll show you what we all look like.
For information on Dr. Ray's presentations, books, and CDs, visit DRA.com and follow him on Facebook and Instagram. The Doctor Is In is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.